Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Minds of Media. My name is Blake Panashevitz, and today's guest is someone who I've been really looking forward to having on this show for a long time. He's probably done nearly everything you can do in esports. He has been a caster in multiple games, a coach, a team owner, and now a partner for a strategic and creative consulting firm called Theory Craft. Please let me introduce Christopher Michaels, maybe better known as Monte Cristo. Welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited to have you on the show. You have an extensive history, I would just like to say. It's actually really impressive, considering like I've had like Sir Scoots on here too, and I thought he was going to be like one of the most I didn't think anyone could come close. And like I've watched some of your background, and I am highly impressed, like doing like the research and you like all the stuff that you've done. It's kind of actually incredible.
It's been a really, really long road in esports, obviously, and there are very few people, Scoots being one of them, Thorin, you know, these kind of people, Alchemist, that have been here as long or longer than me. So it's been interesting to see this entire industry grow from I wasn't there at the start, but close to the start.
Yeah, you were pretty early on there. So I always like to start off the show pretty easily. I don't know if people know this about you, but you are pretty into board games from what I know.
Yeah.
So that being said, what is your favorite board game, you think, that you like to play and why?
So I like turn-based games in general. So I like turn-based PC games as well, including I've played every single Total War game since the original Shogun. I like Crusader Kings. I like a lot of the Paradox games. But in terms of tabletop games, I do really love Twilight Imperium, which is, for those of you who don't know, basically like the most hardcore board game. It takes about 12 hours to play a game. It's wow. Sort of like Settlers of Catan on steroids. So it's a space civilization building game. But you go to war with people, and it is really, you're researching all this technology, building ships. It's a very intense game. There's like 20 something different factions that you can play as, but it's really fun. So if you're looking for something hardcore, if you're looking for something that I like that's less hardcore, I like some cooperative games like Eldritch Horror. I like Scythe as a more reasonable, shorter strategy game. These kind of things. The card game that I play is Legend of Five Rings, which is sort of like the harder version of Magic. So nice. Yeah, I love all of these things.
Nice. Have you always really been into board games since like growing up and stuff?
Not really. I think I got into board games when it started. I think the board game industry itself started to blow up. So it's only been maybe the last 5 or 6 years that I've been doing a lot of tabletop gaming. I was more into role-playing games when I was in high school. So I played White Wolf games. I was never really a big D&D fan, but I played Exalted a lot. I DM'd like a 2-year-long campaign in Exalted in high wow. school. I played Vampire the Masquerade.
Vampire Masquerade is really good. I've never got to play it, but it's on my list. I want to play it. So
yeah, it's really good. I mean, I just prefer more discreet. So the things that I like about those games is I prefer the D10 system because it's simpler. I want more role-playing and less table consulting. So, and I like discrete fleshed out universes, which I know D&D has some of, but it really doesn't. When you have an entire game that is in one universe, like Exalted or Vampire, there's just a lot more material to work with in my experience.
Did you ever play Orpheus or Shadowrun?
I did not play Orpheus or Shadowrun, no.
Yeah, those are both really
I heard great things
too.
About Shadowrun, but I never played it.
Yeah, I played some Shadowrun growing up. I actually grew up playing D&D from like 6. So like my dad, like growing up, he was like, hey, do you want to play this game? And so he got us playing like really old Dungeons and Dragons very early on. So the hype that it's kind of blown up now is kind of, it makes me very happy that more people play it. Because for a long time, role-playing games were kind of looked down upon. And you couldn't really actively go out and be like, oh yeah, I'm just going to play role-playing games. Like you would get judged. Did you ever have any experiences like that? Was it like something that you could actively talk about? Or did you keep it kind of like in the hush hush?
I talked about it just like I talked about any of my other interests. I honestly don't give a fuck and I've never given a fuck about what people think about me. So I had friends that I played it with and I just did what I enjoyed and that didn't really matter what other people thought.
That attitude is something that's, I think, very cool about you and unique. This kind of I don't give a fuck attitude towards like basically anything, like as far as like, I mean, obviously you have people you care about and stuff like that, but it's like, if someone doesn't like what you're doing, that it doesn't really matter. Have you always had that kind of growing up? Like, where does that come from?
I don't know. I've just been always very aggressive about my opinions. I enjoy fighting with people because I like, I think what can make me difficult to work with for some people is that I will always fight and I will keep on fighting until the end of time. And the reason why I do it is because I have a personal belief that conflict yields a greater understanding.
Yeah.
And I don't take it personally. I think a lot of people, when they get into an argument, are really committed to, like, emotionally invested in their idea. And I don't really have emotional investments in my points of view. I just have logical reasoning behind why I think a certain way. And so if somebody's able to convince me, I don't really care about being wrong. I appreciate the process that I've learned something and grown as a result of it. But I think that when you, a lot of people try and talk to me, they perceive me as being super, super aggressive, which I am, but I like people who fight back and who actually challenge me. So I think that sometimes causes some pretty severe conflicts in my professional life because a lot of people just kind of want to get by and they don't want to really examine why they're doing what they're doing or how it could be better or how it could be different. They want to just punch the clock and get out of there, and I will never stop. So I don't work well with people who have that kind of mentality.
Yeah. I mean, you want people who work hard and are going to put in all the work that they possibly can, kind of like you have. I mean, you've done some crazy, I mean, at one point I remember you were working OGN, you were coaching a team, and you were doing a bunch of other stuff. So you have like an insane work ethic. And I think that, I think it's reasonable to say, I want people to do the best that they can when they're working with me. Cause I want to produce the best quality content that we can.
Yeah. And I want people to argue with me, and I respect people who challenge me on my own positions because it forces me to articulate and defend them and figure out if there are any flaws in a system that I've created. So I just kind of treat the thing about working with me, and I was having an interesting conversation with Jat the other day, actually, the League of Legends caster. And we were just talking about our past together and having a very, you know, nice conversation. So this isn't to imply that there's any bad blood. But what he said was that I stretch the truth sometimes. And I said, no, I don't stretch the truth. What happens is when you enter into a conversation or a relationship with me, you are playing on my ethical playing field 100% of the time. So you exist in my ethical universe. And so if I will just treat you as if you are playing by my rules. And so that's the kind of way that I operate. And so if you don't like what happens in that universe, you're probably better just not interacting with me.
Okay, that's a way to put it. So you grew up in Denver, right?
Fort Collins, north of Denver, about 60 miles. So not really a suburb, it's a separate city.
Okay, so what was Colorado like growing up for you?
Well, I'm an only child, so I am very comfortable being alone because I was always kind of by myself, and I can be alone for very long periods of time. And I enjoy having social interaction that I think is meaningful, but I won't socialize just to socialize, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I grew up playing sports, playing video games, spent 15 years acting and have done probably like 30 or 35 theater productions. That was mostly my activities. Enjoyed reading.
What did your parents do growing up?
My father's a marine biologist, and my mother was a Presbyterian minister and now runs the Fort Collins Symphony and has run many other nonprofit organizations in Fort Collins.
Wow, that is really impressive. So where did you get a love for acting? Because you've done a lot of acting, and it's kind of like you're such a logical and real, like, incredibly smart, but you see things. I would imagine you being an engineer. Like, that is the best way to describe. When I hear you talk, it reminds me of, like, because I went to an engineering school, and they talk very much so, like, it's steps, and like you have this logical process. And I was surprised to find out that you went for English in college and not something like engineering. So
I just enjoy literature way more than I can do math. I mean, it's not an issue, but I find creativity much more interesting. And not to say that there isn't creativity in engineering, but yeah. I find evaluating art and thinking about the philosophical and thematic elements of these works to be very gratifying. And I think in terms of acting, I started doing it with a theater company for children in Fort Collins that is still running and is still wonderful, called Debut Theater. And I just did that for since I was about eight. And then I did exclusively Shakespeare in college. But I think that textual analysis and trying to figure out what a character's motivations are and how you can embody that is really fascinating. And I've always found it very rewarding.
So you've been kind of involved with the entertainment industry for a long time then. So starting out very young, when you say you were child acting and doing productions, what does this kind of look like? Like, what scale are we talking about? Are we talking about like traveling across the state? Are we just local or?
Well, just local. I think what's interesting about the theater company that I was in is that it's I did some theater in high school, but I almost did it exclusively with this private company and not with schools. I did a couple shows. I did two shows with my high school, but otherwise I was working with this company that gave better training, frankly, to actors than the high schools or other schools were capable of giving. And also, it was just local theater. And then after I turned 18, which is when you get kicked out, some of my friends and I created our own theater company. And when I was in college, I would do shows in the summer where we would be the ones raising money, putting on productions, building all the sets, everything like that. So we had our own company that we were doing theater with for a few years. It's fun.
Do you have any favorite production that you were in? Like when you look back on, you're like, wow, this was like really, really good. And what were the reasons why?
Well, my last one was probably in college when I was a senior. We did Richard III, and I played Richard III. So obviously that was pretty important to me. And I think it gives a lot of insight. Like Richard III, if you don't know, is a very famous Shakespearean villain. He is crippled, basically. So I had to work with a dance movement coach to get the proper movement down and then really figure out this character, which is a very difficult part to play and has famously been played by many much better actors than me. And then the other one was Metamorphoses, which is a very interesting show by Mary Zimmerman, I believe her name was, which is based on Ovid's Metamorphoses, but a series of vignettes of mythology that are all played around a pool of water on stage. So that was really fun.
Oh, that's really cool. So growing up, did you have like aspirations to do something? Like, were you like, I want to be an actor growing up? Was that a thought that the young Monte Cristo had? Like, I'm going to be a famous actor? Or
it was a thought that I had. And it did inform my college choice. So I went to a liberal arts school, but I went to a liberal arts school that is probably the best non-conservatory acting program in the country. But I realized pretty quickly when I got there, because I had always been part of this theater troupe, and this whole thing is once you were auditioned into this troupe that I was in high school, you were there for the long haul. So many of the friends that I still have today come from that group of people. And what I realized was that what I enjoyed about that process was not that I wanted necessarily to be an actor. It's that I really enjoyed being part of a long-term creative collaboration. And when faced with the prospect of having to live the acting life and go out and audition and really like grind that shit, I realized that it wasn't acting that I liked. It was just having trusted long-term collaborators to make cool shit with. And I think if you look at the way that I've chosen to live my life in terms of casting for 7 years with DOA, working with Thorin for many, many years on our content, that's what I really enjoyed. And I guess I've sort of continued that process within esports, but not really wanting to be it's weird because I thought was that I was going to go probably get a PhD in literature or there was a program at Rice that I was interested in that offers a PhD in Western mysticism, esotericism, and Gnosticism. But once I got into esports, it was sort of I accidentally got back into entertainment. And I think what was good for me about esports was that it allowed me to couple my analytic abilities in terms of being a gamer and a sports fan with the presentation and showmanship that I learned from being an actor. And so a lot of the bits that you've seen that I do with costumes or my timing or the way my delivery, these are all skills that I learned from acting and improv and took me 15 years to learn. And so it was just sort of a natural fit. But I was doing esports because I enjoyed analyzing the game. And then also I had these other skills that I think kind of pushed me over the top in terms of my abilities to do the job.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned improv, and I've heard other people talk about improv. Do you think that more people should be looking to just take improv in general or improve in improv for their like daily lives or even other casters who are kind of working in the scene?
I think what people ask me what they can do is the fact is showmanship is king. So in any entertainment, even in something where you're the color commentator, you're expected to deliver analysis of a game. The thing that will always be more important is your ability to entertain an audience. I have done thousands of games of League of Legends and Overwatch and many other games on broadcast. And I will tell you that the thing that people remember me the most for is blowing a fucking train whistle in a stadium. Okay. So it doesn't matter that I did. I could have been right 100% of the time for 5,000 broadcast hours, but nobody fucking remembers that. People only remember like funny shirt ripping. So like, if you don't have that shit, like you start there, like literally start there and then figure out how to analyze a game, because that is at the end of the day, that is the core thing that people will remember you for. And so people are always asking me, what should I do to get involved in esports? I'm like, well, first off, you need to train your voice. So if you're not acting or singing or doing something where you understand the basics of how to control your voice, then you're doing it wrong, because you could be the smartest person in the world, but if half the audience is annoyed by the way you sound, doesn't mean anything, because they'll just turn it off, right? They're never going to listen to you. They just get hung up on that first impression. And I think that improv or acting or learning how to perform in some way is very important. If you can make it, it's not that you can't make it without doing that, but I think if you actually take a step back and think about who the most famous on-camera people in esports are, they all are good at that to a certain degree.
That makes sense. So you mentioned that you did sports growing up. This competitiveness that you have kind of like in the work environment, have you always had that? Has that been true for like sports too?
Yeah. I mean, I played lacrosse in high school. I grew up playing, you know, going to sports camps for a variety of sports in the summer. I think I was more, I enjoyed the exercise aspect of it, but I played polo in college as well, but I don't really think, what's weird is I don't think my competitiveness was ever really as intense when it came to physical sports compared to me playing like Warcraft 3 ladder when I was in high school. I don't know why, but it just wasn't there.
I
enjoyed it. It's not that I didn't enjoy it. I mean, I did it for multiple, I played lacrosse for multiple years in high school, but I never got quite as focused as when I was trying to be competitive in gaming.
So one of the cool things also is that you kind of went for, it seems like you've almost like carved out your own life and just been like, this is what I feel like doing. This is what I'm going to do, which is, I think, a unique thing that not a lot of people do. They don't just say, I want to do this, and then actually carve their way up to whatever they're going to do. So like your first step would probably be like, hey, I'm going to go for an English major and then maybe go for a PhD. Like it was like, if I'm going to go for a PhD, I'm going to do it. There's not like any question there.
I think there is question there. And I think I didn't do that. And I realized that when I had that plan, that it made me unhappy, because I really like focused on that, thinking when I got out of undergrad, I'm going to apply for grad school and go through this process. And by the end of my undergrad, I was still kind of thinking that way, and it was making me unhappy, because I didn't ever reevaluate or say, oh, actually, you know, what I want has changed, or I don't know what I want. And I didn't know what I wanted to do when I got out of my undergrad. So I took some time to work in a law firm in New York City while I thought about it, because I figured if I don't know what I want to do, I might as well make money so that I can pay to have hobbies or like do other shit, which allowed me to then fund GG Chronicle and esports trips so that I could get involved in the industry, right? So it did end up working out. Really, what I prefer to do these days is provide myself options, which is that I don't get married to a certain thing because you can't predict the future. And I actually live kind of annoyingly to other people in the present, in that I really almost never think about my past. And in fact, I don't even remember a lot of the stuff that happened to me for most of my life. And I pretty much just exist moment to moment. And then what I do in terms of future planning is I create like 10 possibilities. And then I just sort of like see where it goes and see which ones work. And then I just kind of do what works. I don't really think about this is a goal. I'm thinking, hey, this thing might work and this thing might work and this thing might work and this thing might work. So I'm just going to do all of them at the same time. And then I'll just refocus my energy depending on what happens. But I don't have a personal attachment to my own existence, really, or what happens to me. Like, I don't have a goal. If you ask me what my goal is right now, my goal is I want to make more stuff that I want to make, like as vague as that is,
yeah.
Which is why I'm doing weird shit in my stream and why I'm doing Flashpoint for this Counter-Strike stuff and why I'm working with Cloud9, because these are all things that allow me to do things the way that I want to do them. But specifically, if you ask me, well, I've got some ideas for Cloud9, but I'm going to try them and see if they work. And then if they don't, I'm not hung up on changing that if they don't work, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah. Have your parents always kind of supported you doing this?
Oh, yeah.
Being like, yeah, whatever you want to do, go ahead. Because I know, like, I didn't want to go to college at first, and my parents were very against me not going to college. And
my parents, like, I take care of myself, so I think that there was very little worry there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I graduated in the worst recession since the Great Depression in 2009.
Yeah.
And I was bartending and waiting tables after college and then, you know, applying for jobs, but I wasn't asking for money. I was taking care of myself, and they just kind of love me unconditionally, and they don't really care what I do, and I don't ask them for anything. And I've never moved back home with them or anything like that. So I guess, like, I'm so incredibly self-motivated that they probably don't have a lot of reason to be concerned about my ability to take care of myself.
That's fair. That's fair. You mentioned that you were a bartender. Do you have any favorite drinks that you normally like to make?
Tons. I mean, I am very passionate about cocktails. Sure. I mean, I love many, many kind of cocktails. I've worked at some very nice bars. When I have parties at my house, I make, you know, very complex punches from like the Dead Rabbit, which is a very famous bar in New York. I enjoy Aviations recently, Sazeracs. I mean, I can make a lot. I have an extensive bar myself, so okay. It's definitely a passion of mine.
Okay, I started getting into drinking whiskey recently, and it's like the door is like you open it up and you're like, what did I step into?
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's something that you can enjoy the rest of your life. So
yeah.
It's wonderful. I mean, some of my favorite, I prefer, it depends if we're talking scotch, rye, bourbon, whatever, but you know, some of my favorites are, my favorite scotch is Bowmore, which is an Islay malt, which is a little smokier, salty, because the casks are all aged in this cave under the sea, and the seawater drips from the ceiling under the cask.
Oh,
so it gets
cool.
Kind of this saltwater flavor. It's delightful.
Huh. That is incredible. So you go to college, right? And you're going for English. At what point do you start to realize that you're not happy with the way that your life is going?
I mean, I was pretty happy at the time. I mean, I just realized that I was holding myself in my senior year, because things got real weird when I went and lived in Ireland for a year. In my junior year, because I was sort of apprenticing, it's not exactly the right word, but whatever, with this Irish storyteller who lived outside of Galway. So I basically just ditched class in Dublin and go live at his house and learn how to do oral tradition storytelling. And, he runs a nonprofit organization called Spirit Horse, which owns this valley in Wales and sets up camps that are all about oral tradition storytelling and sort of elaborate rituals, as vague as that sounds. So I spent a year with running around with him and his organization. And I think by the time I came back, I was just like, I had changed a lot as a result of this. And I think that was when I was just like, wait, this doesn't even make sense anymore. So part of my entrance into, I had already started casting when I was 18, but I think that part of that was a development of being really understanding the fundamentals of how mythology and stories operate, and being able to fluently tell those stories on the fly was something that I worked very hard on for a year.
I think that being able to storytell in like the esports entertainment industry, I don't think people realize that, but there has to be like some sort of story. And you guys, I'm assuming, work really hard on kind of like creating those stories and working on those stories for like the broadcast. They happen and then you talk about them. If you don't, then I'm just like going to shut the fuck up.
I mean, I feel like I don't have to work very hard on that because my life, like basically I have a literature degree, but my degree focus was really in mythology and oral tradition storytelling. And so I've read so much Joseph Campbell. I know I've done a lot of the research about how to break these stories and these myths down into their constituent parts, that it's actually very easy for me to structure them in that way because I've had to do it on the fly. You know, when you are forced into a situation where you have a story and you must tell it, and this story might be 30 minutes or an hour long, and you're going to have to improvise some of it because you haven't memorize word for word everything. And it's important you don't do that too, because there might be some little detail or flourish that you feel inspired to add in the moment, right?
Yeah.
So because I spent years of my life literally doing this, I think I struggle with that less than perhaps some other people.
Question for you, because this is something you mentioned that sometimes people view you as hard to work with. Do you work well with people who aren't as experienced too? Like, let's say someone didn't have the experience in storytelling. Is that something that you're as long as they're willing to put in the work, everything is fine?
Yeah, ask questions. Like, I'm happy. I'm actually quite collaborative with people who are motivated. It's just motivation is the key thing. And to be clear, I am difficult to work with. That's okay. Just true. It's not. I don't think it's a perception. I think that as long as you're motivated, though, I think motivated people find me quite pleasant.
That's completely fair. So you end up getting out of college and you decide that you're not going for a PhD anymore. And you start working in bars, you mentioned, and you were applying for jobs. What kind of jobs you're applying for? Obviously, you got a job as a paralegal, which I need to, like, later on, I will ask you, how the fuck does one go from an English degree to getting into legal stuff? But
oh, that's actually really easy. That's a really easy question to answer. The reason why I did that was because I had an English degree, and because in the Northeast, if you've gone to an elite undergrad program like I did, usually the path to law school goes like this. You graduate with a liberal arts degree from an elite institution, and then you go to New York City where big law exists, and you serve as a paralegal for a couple of years, and then the partners of that firm, who have oftentimes almost always have gone to top 10 law schools, then write you referral letters to law schools as you take the LSAT. Oh. And then many of those people become lawyers. So it's pretty common. The difference with me is I never intended to go to law school. So I started working with a firm that had, basically, there were four part. I'm not going to get into the legalese of all of this. It was a small, very elite firm that had broken off. The partners had broken off from big law firms during the recession to cut their rates, and then they kept all their clients. So it was a very small, very intelligent group of people. And I was technically a paralegal, but because the law firm only took people who had federal judicial clerkships, we didn't have first or second year associates. So I ended up basically being a first and second year associate. And that was really like great experience. But the reason I did it was because it was one of the best ways to live in New York City and make good money as an English major instead of going to publishing or things that pay you shit. Because I figured if I don't know what I want to do, I might as well make money and figure it out so I have resources and options. And this extra money allowed me to do things like found this journalism website and go to events and start covering them. And I wouldn't have had the money to do that otherwise.
Okay. I mean, I guess that makes sense. Did you learn a lot about the like legal proceedings than I take it from working at this law firm, which I know that owning a business and doing contracts, you learn so much about the law when you have to actually be involved in it. You're like, holy Jesus.
Yeah, I'm very comfortable and conversational around contracts and legal terms now. So it's much easier for me to parse through a lot of that kind of language as a result of me spending 3 years working at this firm.
So that brings me up into an interesting dynamic then. Obviously, you've come through the esports scene, seeing you're not old, but you've been through a lot of it and you've seen a lot of it, and especially some of the bad contracts. Like when I had heard about some of these things happening going on, I was like kind of dumbfounded and floored, especially some of the like the parties involved in these things. What do you think about when you hear these kinds of things happening? Do you go to the onus of like, well, you guys should just know better and you should probably get someone that does it, or where do you kind of lie?
I mean, I've always been very concerned with the ethical side of the industry, and Bryce Blum and ESG Law, which is the major law firm for most teams these days, we were one of the early teams on Renegades to use them. And part of what we were doing was that we used Bryce's contracts, which are kind of industry standard player contracts today, and we were one of the first teams to use those. So I believe very deeply in creating fair contracts for players, and that was always one of the goals with Renegades.
So kind of looking at getting into esports, you're working at this paralegal firm. Did you know that you wanted to make a career in esports? Was that something like, oh, no, I'm just going to carve this out?
Or I didn't even know it was possible.
You were just going to invest in covering them?
So here again, going back, I just do things, and if they work, I continue doing them. I didn't think I would ever get a full-time job, and I wasn't doing it to get a full-time job.
Yeah.
I was just doing it because I enjoyed it, and I was working and casting MLG, and I was just having a great time.
Yeah.
So I sort of, you know, when I got the job offer from OGN, thanks to Torch, Trevor Houston, who works at Blizzard now, because I talked to him, and he was leaving OGN to come back to the States and work for Blizzard, and they needed somebody, and he put me up in front of Crisis Wee, who was then the longtime lead producer at OGN, and I did interviews with them, and they reviewed my casting, among other possible people that they could have hired, and they ended up picking me, and they gave me 2 weeks during Hurricane Sandy to leave New York and move to Seoul, and I had never been to Korea before, but I had grown up watching OGN, so it was like a dream come true. But yeah, it wasn't really planned.
So you started casting when you were right around 18. Did you continue it up, or did you, like, were you still casting this time when you were doing paralegal stuff?
Yeah, well, I was casting a lot because I was running my own tournaments through my website, GG Chronicle, and they had TSM and CLG and all the teams. And then I was casting at MLG. So yeah, I was still casting at the time. I was casting for my first 2 years of college. And then when I left for Ireland, I stopped for a couple years. And then I got back into esports once I graduated college, because I was watching a lot of StarCraft II at GSL at the time. And then when League of Legends started growing, because I had been in their offices in beta, because my college roommate was one of their first employees at Riot. And he invited me after I graduated college to come to LA and basically crash with him for a week and just check out this new game studio, Riot Games, which had maybe like 50 employees at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember talking, I stayed there for a week in their offices, and this was before the game launched. And I remember having conversations with Mark Merrill and Brandon Beck, the president and CEO of the company. And they were like, hey, we hear you're the esports guy. Is this going to be a good esport? And I said, this game's fucking amazing. Like, this is going to be a great esport. And I had long conversations with them while I was there about its viability. So I was in League since day one. And as soon as the esports scene started to pick up around it, that's when I founded my journalism website. And I was like, this is insane. And I remember just being absolutely blown away, because this was the very early days of Twitch and Own3D and some of those other streaming platforms. And the numbers were just bananas. I mean, when I was running my tournaments in early 2012, out of my apartment in Brooklyn, I was getting 40,000 concurrent viewers.
Holy
which
Jesus.
Is just like insane. And I had this website, and I was paying for all its operations, and their volunteer writers, and I was writing on it. And we were getting 50,000, 100,000 page views. And I was like, holy shit, how does nobody know how big this is? This game is enormous. Like these are unreal numbers.
Yeah.
It was a really interesting time. But at that point I was like, wow, this is going to be massive. So I decided to kind of go all in.
So this brings me into another question. I've had talks with different people from like Kelsey Moser and stuff like that about journalism in esports and the struggles of journalism in esports, because it feels like there's a bunch of companies that kind of come up and then they collapse. And the only really like longstanding company is there's like Deserto that's been around for a decent amount of time. There's ESPN, which is funded by Disney. But other than that, it doesn't really seem like journalism is yet a viable solution in esports. Would you agree with that or disagree with that beyond those companies?
So I think we can ask ourselves, is journalism a viable solution in any capacity?
That's true. No, you're right.
I think that's right. A fair question that we can ask. I think that we have seen kind of the death of local journalism in a lot of local papers. Even major cities have had their newspapers taken over by finance groups and then just gutted. So there's a real question, I think, in general about the profitability of journalism without it being shitty clickbait. And I think that extends to esports, because really esports is just a very small section of overall journalism, like very, very, very small. And it's extremely hard to monetize. And unless you're a big name that can produce your own content and really stand behind that, unless you're like Thorne or Richard Lewis that has a huge fan base that you can monetize that kind of content around, it's hard. It's extremely hard, even for very good journalists. So let's put it this way. If I knew how to make money off of that, I would be doing that. Right.
Okay. That's
because I tried and I ended up losing a bunch of money. So, and I don't regret it, but that is a very tough nut to crack.
So the reason I kind of bring this up is it's almost terrifying, the thought of like not having like journalistic publications, because at least traditionally I would say that like journalism is one of the things that holds people accountable, right? Like reporting on like bad things that people do. And we've seen cases where Richard Lewis has broken news or Jacob Wolf has broken news. And I hope that these are things that hold like teams and stuff accountable. But if journalism starts to go away minus like a few people, does that start to hold the ecosystem less responsible?
Yes, but I do think that there's significantly less unethical behavior going around now that the ecosystem has really matured and we have all these professional sports teams coming in. So it's a lot less shitty than it used to be. And I also think that people like Thorne and Richard Lewis and not often, but occasionally me have been able to call out bad practices. And there are many other good journalists who do that as well, obviously. So I think it's fine. I mean, I will say it's a lot less shitty than it used to be in esports, thanks to more money being involved.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not dealing with fucking betting scandals or any of that garbage anymore. People literally going to prison. So thank God for that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, you forget about some of those things if you don't go back and like look at them. So
especially if you're not familiar with Korean esports, you may not be familiar with the sheer number of betting scandals that happened or how bad it was. I mean, there's still betting scandals that I know of in Korean esports that have never been reported on.
Yeah, yeah, I've heard that. The
I know they exist, but I can't say anything about them, and it's upsetting. But they did happen.
Yeah, I've heard that there's a lot of, for Korea specifically, there's actually a lot of political stuff that happens behind the scene that no one ever hears about.
Well, the problem with journalism in Korea is that there isn't an incentive, because if you previously, and I think it is changing to be fair, but a lot of the reporters know about really fucked up shit that goes on, and everybody knows that it's happening. And no one ever says anything, because if you report on it, then you are ostracized from esports. So these people would literally lose their job for reporting on it, which is like incredibly, it seems very weird from a Western perspective that would be the truth, but it is. And so they just don't report on it. So all this shit just gets swept under the rug.
Yeah, that is, like, I wish there was something we could do about it. There's just, I don't know if, I think there's some things in the world that you can't really do much about it. Like, I, as shitty as that sounds to say, there's just some things that there aren't really easy solutions for.
So, yeah, I don't, I think it is changing over time, though. I think we're seeing more, more engagement in that way from the Korean journalists. But for many 15 years, it wasn't, you know, it didn't work like that, so.
Yeah. So on one of the reflections you did with Thorin, one of the things that you had mentioned is that you're a really angry person. You found useful ways to channel that anger. I think it was the one that was 2 years ago. I watched all of them like back to back when I was doing this.
I'm sorry I didn't do that.
No. I'd actually, this is the second watch through because I used to watch all of Thorin's. Thorin was actually one of the big reasons that I started this series is because he was the one who did like personal interviews with people in the esports scene. So he was like one of the people that I was like, yeah, this is a person that I kind of like want to model what I'm kind of doing off of. So I watched through a lot of your guys' stuff because of that. So that being said, you had said that you'd found useful ways to channel this kind of like anger. How do you do that? How do you channel your anger? Because there's a lot of people who get very angry and can't channel it very usefully.
I'm not ruled by it. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, sometimes it gets the best of me, but I just have an ability to sort of observe it from the outside. I think that if you understand how to meditate and sort of disassociate from your perception, that it's not very hard to really like take a step back and sort of observe why you're mad. And I think with me, most of the time I'm mad because something isn't as good as it could be, or it's being done incompetently. And so that usually I can just examine it and then I'll just figure out a way to do something different entirely or remove myself from the situation and try and fix it. Cause like I'll see something and I'll be mad and I'll be like, why the fuck is this thing being done in this way? This is so annoying. So I will find a different way to either create something that fixes that problem or to criticize it in a way that I hope will fix it. And I think that's what a lot of people don't understand is they view a lot of my criticism as being salty or that I can't move on. And the thing is, I will never move on because this is my industry and I feel like I have an ethical obligation given my level of deep knowledge of the scene and the history of it to make it better. And so for me, just to give up on something because I don't like it is stupid because the criticism I am hoping will force it to be fixed. Right. Yeah. And it's one of those things where if you don't say anything, that is never, then if big voices do nothing with that ability, then it's never going to change and it's never going to get better. You just let the shitters win. You know, and I will never let the shitters win in this industry. Like you come here, you are entering into my sphere of criticism and that's how it's just going to be.
Do you think that big names have kind of a responsibility to talk about things, whether that would be
I agree. Yes, 100%.
Do you think that stems into political too?
What do you mean?
So like, as a good example, like people who would criticize Blizzard on Hong Kong. That would be an easy example that I could pull up. Do you think that people have a responsibility to step out who are like big names and say something about it?
What I will say about that incident is that it's very difficult to comment on that because regardless of anyone's personal feelings, there is nothing we can do to help that situation by making posts on social media about it.
Yeah.
I try and affect things that I know I can influence or that I hope I can influence. Geopolitics, regardless of my feelings, is not one of those things. And I will say that as somebody who works in esports, China is incredibly important to the industry and to everyone's job in this industry. And so whatever personal feelings that I may have about that situation, it is hard for anyone to comment on it without becoming a target of an extremely powerful government. And there are trade-offs that have to be made, unfortunately.
No, I think that's reasonable. I think that's reasonable, and I think that that makes sense. I know some people believe that you should comment about everything, and I think that you do.
I think you should comment on the things over which you feel that you have a measure of control over. If I thought that I could change geopolitical conversations and realities by tweeting, I would do it, even if it came as a personal cost of myself. However, sometimes you just hurt yourself without having any effect whatsoever, is my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. So kind of jumping off that, do you think there are any systematic problems with esports that you would like to see changed? Like if you see things now, you're like, wow, these are big ones. I know for a while it was caster rates were one of the things that I think about when I think of Monty is like, this is something that you fought really hard for. Is there anything currently in the ecosystem that you're like, these things need to change now?
I think what's tragic about what has happened in the last couple of years in esports, and I do think it's changing, especially through projects like Flashpoint, which are really embracing endemic people. So if you look at my background, I have casted 7 different games. As you said at the start of this, I've owned a professional team. I have coached professional teams. I've owned my own businesses. I sold, albeit at gunpoint, my first 7-figure business when I was under 30. So I have an experience in all of these aspects. I'm a well-educated individual, and I have 15 years of esports experience. Now, one would think that as I approach my mid-30s, that I would be a prime candidate to be in a leadership position in many of these major projects. And for whatever reason, most of these big leagues have gone out of their way to not hire qualified esports professionals who have risen within the industry, who are objectively as qualified as the people who they are hiring. But we also have the bonus of literally being from esports.
Yeah.
And I think that these people should be much more seriously considered for these kind of projects because they are, including me, which is why I'm enjoying working on Flashpoint right now, is that we understand the industry, we understand the audience, we understand the games better than anyone else. And if everyone says that the key to esports is authenticity, then you better start hiring these people to be authentic at an executive level, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when like Jason Alchemist didn't get rehired for Overwatch. Like I remember a lot of people kind of complained about that and not like that happening and saying that he was really qualified to work, whether or not you agree or disagree with that. I don't know. But it seems that the IPs that have started to run tournaments are the thing that scare me the most about esports and their control over it, because they made the game and they control the IPs, but then they also control all of the circuit. Whereas if you look at like the NFL, obviously they don't own the game football. And that's like the most terrifying concept I think about esports right now, is that the game developers are what holds the IP for the game and they control everything.
It just depends on what they do with the IP. Valve doesn't care what you do with the Counter-Strike IP. Right? We can make Flashpoint and it's fine. And yes, they've given their sign off, but they really have a hands-off approach. Now, other developers could do exactly the same thing. That isn't what many developers are doing, obviously. I disagree with that fundamentally because I think if you have if your core business expertise, this is just a business question. If your core business expertise is making games, why the fuck would you think that you can produce a sports league? That makes no sense. Like you will inevitably make mistakes along the way that other people who know how to do that would not have made. So I find that deeply confusing that these subsidiary businesses are most of the time poorly run on the developer side with the wrong people in charge. And there are so many fundamental pains because they don't know what they're doing, that it is troubling. And having worked for OGN for 5 years, who was exceptionally good at producing tournaments and running broadcasts, it is very frustrating to see everything that OGN learned over 20 years just be discarded, and these companies have to make all of these really, really stupid mistakes that never have to be made, because if you ask the right people or you hired the right people, they could explain why it was a bad idea in 10 seconds and how they had learned that it was a bad idea. Yeah. Because we don't have to reinvent the wheel. The wheel already exists. Just use the fucking wheel, you know? And that's what's been annoying. That's part of what we're doing with Flashpoint is, guess who learned a lot from working with OGN and talking to OGN's producers? Me. We already know from 20 years of OGN production what works.
Yeah.
And yes, it has to be adapted to a Western audience. Some of the stuff will only work for a Korean audience. There are cultural differences. But at the end of the day, the way we did the format was we created a format that was an echo of MSL from 2010, 2011 in Brood War with the group selection process, because we know it works and we know it's fucking cool. Why don't we just use it? So we will use it. You know, there's no need to be inventive when you don't have to be.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of companies or organizations just want to recreate the email so they can be like special. That's the only thing that, like, they want to have their own like special little thing, and you don't need your own special little thing.
No,
like,
you don't.
Just do something that's good, that works. So.
Exactly. And I think that we've seen the fans, if you look at the relative viewership of Counter-Strike compared to the player base. Now, Counter-Strike is definitely not one of the most played games. But it is definitely one of the highest viewed games.
Yes.
And the reason is because when you leave it to its own devices, now there are many reasons. It's a great game to watch. It is fundamentally the best esport to watch from a pacing perspective, from an observational perspective, from a burden of knowledge perspective. Yep. All of these things make it great. But the other thing that makes it great is that organically, it has figured out a very good system for running a series of tournaments and building excitement. And that's just something that happened because it was allowed to happen, because in an environment where people had to compete against each other, different tournament organizers and production companies, they had to be innovative and they had to compete against each other for viewership. Yeah. If you just create something wholesale and you own the entire market, you never fucking know what could happen. Like, what would increase viewership? Because there's no competition. There's literally nothing else that says, oh, this person's doing something else. Look at their viewership. It's 50% higher than ours. So we're just left with shit, basically.
Yeah. So one of the things is you have left Blizzard Entertainment from working with them. And the quote I have is, for creative and philosophical differences. One of the unique things is that when you left Riot to join Blizzard, one of the things you were is like, they treated you so well and they were so good and they paid you more. I think the huge quote that I saw was, they paid you more in 2 weeks than Riot did in 5 weeks for the world stage.
Yep. All true.
Working for that. What changed over the 2 years philosophically? Because obviously when you came in, you were really happy.
It wasn't 2 years. It was 6 months. It was when Nate Danzer left. That was it. You know, Nate, I like Nate a lot. I think Nate had very interesting goals for the Overwatch League that were overridden by other people. Mm-hmm. I think Nate is awesome. And when Nate left, in my opinion, like, a lot of the creative vision behind the league departed with him. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't anything to fill that void, really. I mean, I think you can see that if you literally watch the broadcast this season. Yeah. I think you can see what is the creative vision of Overwatch League. Mm-hmm. I don't see one. Do you see any shoulder content? No. Do you see any features about players? No. It's just games, and like, there's no packaging. There's nothing driving stars. It's not very good, in my opinion, right now. Compelling broadcast.
They obviously just went to YouTube, which that deal could be good or bad. Like, I think that depending on what YouTube said, like, because YouTube's algorithmic power is kind of incredible, because obviously they're owned by Google. And so if you were to sign a deal with YouTube, I could see that being very beneficial for if they were to maybe shift some of your content algorithmically to be in front of more eyes. But if you're not making any content to begin with, I don't think it matters. So
I we're 2 weeks in. I mean, I can look. I honestly haven't been watching very much. But I've been kind of keeping an eye on it. Cause I just, unfortunately, as much as I enjoyed my time in the Overwatch League, like, they're, you know, I don't have a career reason to watch it right now. So I watch it occasionally for fun, but considering that my content is focused around League of Legends and working up with some other projects on Counter-Strike, basically, like, it is much more useful to me to watch Blast and LCS and LEC and all these other CSGO tournaments. So, you know, it unfortunately hasn't given me a lot of time. I mean, I'm looking right now. And so first off, they did no content for 3 months before the start of the league. They didn't release a single YouTube video. And then I'm looking right now and I see one top five plays of opening weekend and like best players at Philly, but there's no like player focused content. There's no features. There's like it's like montages. They made some montages and that's it.
I feel like we're watching like individual streamers put up content. That's what it feels like.
I feel, you know, maybe people will disagree. I feel like we had frag movies in 2002, and maybe we could move beyond that in terms of how we tell player and team storylines, and maybe we could make some of that content, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't really know what's going on over there. Just strikes me as very weird how stripped down the entire experience has become.
So they kind of did some backhanded comments towards all, I would say, like a lot of the casting talent who ended up leaving. And I thought that was kind of, you guys had some back and forth scats a little bit on Twitter. And I think it all kind of resolved, kind of. I'm going to say kind of right now. Why do you think that happened? Like, why throw shade at a bunch of casters who had worked since literally before the game had been conceptualized, right? Signed contract with them before the game was even released, right? Brought them in, literally gave up their lives to work on it. Why throw shade at?
I was a consultant. I was a consultant in 2017 and 2018 for the league.
Yeah.
I worked with some of the team owners on how to structure their teams, especially sports team owners that were coming in. I would have phone calls with them to tell them exactly which staff members they needed to hire, how to build out their orgs as a former team owner myself. I did a lot of consulting on the formats. I did a lot of consulting on creative aspects of the league. I spoke with Nate a lot about various initiatives that I was pushing for. I don't now, some of those comments have been walked back as misspoken. So I will take them at their word on that. And not assume that they are doing any kind of damage control. But I don't know. I mean, it seems like a very, very weird thing.
Yeah, it's fair. So kind of looking, one of the things I wanted to ask you about Overwatch is I had Crumbs on. It hasn't been released yet, but by the time this comes out, it will have been released. And he mentioned that the Overwatch League, he felt very censored is probably the best word that he put. Was there ever a feeling of like Blizzard kind of like censoring what you guys wanted to put out or talk about, like as far as the broadcast?
So when I signed my contract, what I was told was that they wanted it to have sort of the tone of Inside the NBA, if you're familiar with the whole Shaq Barkley show that they do, which is banter, a lot of fun content, a little more mature. And that really appealed to me because that's the kind of content that I like to make. And then we signed a deal with Disney XD. And you can't really do that on Disney XD. And not only that, but when you're trying to appeal to an audience that doesn't know the game, you are sort of forced to cast in certain ways, and we were asked a lot to change the kind of focus of our cast and make it for a more casual audience, which is why I find it very strange that they've gone the sort of broadcast direction that they have, where they say, you know, we wanted the people who live and breathe Overwatch, which was, I mean, even from the outside, you can see it. That was literally not their objective for the first 2 years. And nobody ever questioned that. Nobody said, wait a second, like, you literally were trying to put this on ABC and Disney XD and ESPN, and you were literally making all of these like explainer videos for the different map types to cater to somebody who knew nothing about it. You were telling your casters, you need to make this more accessible. Okay, so we did. And then this year, suddenly they're like, oh yeah, we definitely want pro players who don't have any casting training or abilities because they offer more insight. And it's just like, wait, you literally just 180'd on your entire tone of broadcast. And this is what I find so frustrating, was that there was, in my mind, there was never, why Overwatch League fundamentally, I think, lacks direction is because there was never a creative focus. When we came in, when I signed my contract, it was, let's do something more like Inside the NBA. Then it just 180'd to, oh, let's do Disney. And then it's 180'd back to, oh, we're catering to hardcore fans. They sold the thing before they knew what it was. Like, they had an idea, but then they sold it in a way that they couldn't execute on it. And then now that Disney XD and ESPN and everything and ABC aren't there anymore, now they're trying to pivot back to a hardcore audience. It's really weird. And I think it's just a bad way to run a product, personally. Yeah.
So one of the things that's kind of attached with Overwatch League is there's a lot of money involved with Overwatch League. There's a lot of teams who have had a lot of buy-ins. And it scares me that, well, I guess my first spin, do you think that Overwatch League is going to be around in like 5 years? Like, if it goes on its current trajectory, do you think it will still be sustainable?
Well, it's not sustainable right now, but it wasn't intended to be, right? This is a long-term investment for a lot of these sports teams in order to enter the esports market in a more long-term way. Now, I do think it will be around in 5 years because it's too big to fail. Like, okay. Activision Blizzard is a publicly traded company. You have to ask yourself, what is the stock price effect if the league were to fail? And the answer is probably not great. It's not going to devastate the company, obviously. It's an enormous company, but they're not going to do things that would allow it to fail publicly. So I think what it does need is an adjustment in terms of what it is to match the size of its audience. I do think one of the things Overwatch League does magnificently is sell. I think they're amazing at selling. And I think it's good for the industry that they sell. A lot of people will be like, oh, you know, they sold this Twitch deal was way too much money. Or this, look at all these sponsors they had. They kicked everyone's ass in the entire world of esports in year one of the Overwatch League with sponsorship sales. So mad credit to them. And I think that raises all boats, because if they're actually extracting the maximum amount of value that they can, then it's going to help other esports products also get better sponsorship deals. And I think esports for a long time has been undervalued compared to the size of the audience, and specifically the target market, which is the most desirable, overwhelmingly male, 18 to 35. That is the most desirable market for many companies. And so Overwatch League did everybody a favor by kicking asset sales. And so I think that Overwatch League is, you know, will be in a good place and has been a market leader in many ways. And I think it has been good, I think, for the space in a lot of ways that many people perceive it as bad because they think it's overvalued. If anything, in my opinion, other products are undervalued.
So you don't think it can be bad then? Like, because
it's not going to die. I mean, I think that's a ridiculous premise. Like, it just needs to adjust to it will level out, right? It's a business.
Yeah.
It one way or another, it's going to meet in the middle between where it's real viewership is without token farming and without being on TV with people who forget to turn the TV off, right? Because there isn't a noticeable difference, as far as I can tell, in the TV ratings of that time slot that Overwatch League is on ABC compared to literally anything else that you could put on in that time slot. Like, it's not a draw, let's put it that way, for linear television viewers. It just is there. So in that case, like, I think it'll just naturally balance out. And I don't think that, you know, I don't think it can continue on the current trajectory that it's continuing on, but can it still be a perfectly viable esport? Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it can be, I think it can continue to run, and it can continue to run in a healthy way, and we'll get to that point.
Yeah. Do you think that it's hard considering that it's geolocation? Because I think of like the cost, I'm thinking about like the cost of a team and just like geolocation in itself and like the travel that's required and like the team up costs and all that seems incredibly expensive for what is going on. Like, especially if it's downscaling, that is kind of the thing that worries me the most. Is I don't think it's going to collapse I would like to state that, because I agree with you that Activision Blizzard has way too much money to let something like this collapse. But does it turn off other marketing deals from happening to other esports? And does it turn off maybe other endemic brands looking to get into the scene?
Nah, I think those brands will just look at Overwatch and pay what they think is fair, and then they will pay more or less depending on the audience size of other esports. The market will correct itself. It's not really a concern, I don't think, in the bigger picture. It's a concern to the people who work on Overwatch League potentially, because I don't think that viewership is going to increase. So if you're making decisions based off of that, but it certainly will continue to have solid week over week viewership. It's fine. Like it's not in some sort of death spiral, right? And I think in terms of localization, yes, it is expensive to run, but it is offset by the fact that you can sell tickets to these home stands. I think that Overwatch is in a place where even if you're not a regular Overwatch fan, people will take their kids there for a day on the weekend because it comes around 2 to 5 times a year in your city. I think in China, it'll do quite well. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to see those Chinese home stands yet. So I think that in terms of live viewership, it may have a very, compared to other esports, a small-ish group of concurrent viewers, but the fans are very hardcore. They buy a lot of merch. They turn out to the venues and they cheer on their teams. So it seems like it can continue to run at the same level it is currently.
Yeah. Sometimes they're a little too hardcore, but that's okay. That's okay. Sometimes they're scary, but what can you do? Looking at Flashpoint, this is the newest endeavor that you're kind of working on. One of the cool things is actually in one of your reflections, you actually talked about Thorin and you two possibly working together in the future. And one of the things you guys said is you didn't think it would ever happen because he would never leave CS probably, and you didn't know if you would ever get into CS. And it's worked now. You're both in Flashpoint. What's it like working with Thorin in this professional sense, seeing as it's something you guys have probably wanted to do as far as like casting and working together in that sense?
It doesn't really change anything that we've done before because we've always collaborated on creating content. So it's just on a bigger scale with a bigger budget, but certainly it's fun. I think he's an extremely intelligent person, and I really appreciate his knowledge of the scene and his ability to help me out in terms of learning more about Counter-Strike. He has an absolutely incredible memory for games and for results and for understanding how to evaluate teams at different points in their professional existences. So he's always a really good source of information if I have questions. But yeah, it's fun. It's really fun because we both understand the history of esports so well that it doesn't take any time when we're discussing, like, should we do an MSL format? We both know exactly what that means. And we can be like, yes, we should do that. And then I run off and work out all the details, right? Which is what the format was collaborative in terms of concept. In terms of execution, it was me and Ken from Cloud9, who's a data scientist who was helping me out with some of the more fiddly point and veto details that we had to run through a variety of scenarios together. So yeah, it's been, and then Face It obviously helping with some of the standardization of rules across Counter-Strike that I wouldn't necessarily be aware of what a standard sixth tiebreaker is, right, in Counter-Strike, because I haven't read one of the rule books in depth. So that kind of stuff is really fun in terms of content. We both like very similar things when it comes to esports broadcasts and the kind of content that we enjoy watching and we enjoy making. So it's good. And it's been very helpful that the owners have been really bought into this process.
So kind of looking at content, one of the cool things is it seems like this content is going to be way more set up for an adult audience, as at least based on the stuff that I've seen so far and read. What was the theory behind going into that? Because I like that idea and I wish more esports actually did that, because I'm sorry, but I'm not a 12-year-old child watching Disney. So
I think that may have been not the best use of audience targeting on behalf of the Overwatch League, especially if they were going to reverse course and then try and go back to their hardcore fan base. Very weird. I think that for us, it just means that there's been so many things that have tried to cater to all audiences in esports. And to be fair, in the past, if we rewind the clock to 7-8 years ago, many of the people who were fans were 15 or 16 years old. Yeah. However, these people are now in their mid-20s. And I think we should ask ourselves, has the product actually changed that much? Well, every year, more esports fans become adults and interested in adult content. Yeah. The growing market of people in their late 20s and 30s of esports consumers is growing every single year. And that audience is just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, because I think many people are still going to be watching esports and into their 80s at this point in time. Yeah. So basically, we're just trying to say we're planting our flag in this space and saying, well, somebody's got to be the first one here to do this in a very serious way. So let's use a game that will never be acceptable for children, that adults really like to watch, that has probably the largest contingent of fans, viewers in their late 20s and 30s. And let's do something for them where we are explicitly not for kids. And you know what's great about doing this is you get the kids to watch too, because it seems taboo and they want to rebel. So we'll get them too. It's fine. Yeah. Like, we're going to make something that is intelligent and made for hardcore adult esports fans. And no one else has said they're doing that. So we'll just do it and see what happens.
Now, another cool thing about Flashpoint, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is the first league that is owned by the teams. Right, where they have ownership.
It's
and direction with that ownership.
I'm not sure what the CGS organization was how much the teams owned of CGS, for example, that massive failure. I'm not exactly sure what the business arrangement of that was. Certainly, it was partially owned by DirecTV. But what's exciting about this is it's the first thing in modern times that is collectively owned by the teams. And I think this is an important step forward, because who better understands the nature of competition than the teams? And honestly, in certain ways, because in esports, the teams are necessarily content creation machines, because they have sponsorship obligations and they've been making these deliverables for years, who better to create content than the teams as well? Unless you're going to hire somebody like OGN or ESL. But the problem with that is that OGN and ESL take a chunk of the profits that I don't think is necessary for them to take. So the different strategy has been, let's hire me, Thorin, Semler, Moses, all these casters who have been doing this for years, who understand content, who make content on their own, and say, what do you guys think? If you guys actually had money for once, what would you make? And we're just like, oh, well, we make all this stuff. And like, okay, here's your money. And we say, okay, and we do it. So I think that they realize what they didn't know about this. And we have some good producers as well from Face It and tournament organizers who are involved, who are very experienced. And so they've decided that, you know, they should be the ones operating this league, because it's in their best interest. And just like in traditional sports, who owns the leagues? The teams do. Surprise. Yeah. Right. So it's a model that we already know exists and works well. And because, unlike, say, professional sports teams, esports teams have always been content creators. In fact, you could point at FaZe and you could say, some teams like FaZe, you could be like, you are actually just a content creator with the team attached to it. Right. Yep. So, and in many ways, that's the more profitable business model.
Yep. Yep, so, that's, I've always thought that why don't teams do more with content? Because like your FaZe Clans, your old Outlaws, that's what they used to be, is functionally just content creation teams with teams attached to them, and they did very, very well. And FaZe still does very, very well. So
100 Thieves also. So yeah, there's, I mean, I think you can see with my participation in Cloud9 that, you know, part of what I'm doing right now, I can't talk a lot about what my future plans are, but it's a lot of fucking content, you know? So other teams are heading down this road and realizing that they need very strong content wings attached to them, or to literally just be a content wing that has teams on it.
So, what exactly is your role with Flashpoint? Because I don't know if it's been publicly stated. Are you going to be doing casting? I know you're doing are you like a content director, or
I'm making various pieces of content right now. I'm driving the creative process around a lot of this content. I will probably be like a desk host and like a pre or post show person. I won't be casting. I don't have the Counter-Strike chops yet to do that. But I think maybe in a year, once I get some more of this experience under my belt, maybe I will start commentating. We'll see.
Okay. Okay. And you, I would ask you your future goals, but we've already been over that. You just kind of do things.
I can tell you, like, my goals right now are I'm building out some very bizarre character streams for myself that I have done one of so far and will do more of soon. So that's sort of something that I'm testing right now and seeing where that goes. I'm developing many more pieces of content that I'm working on with Cloud9 on, besides just doing Summoning Insight. One of the things I really want to do, for example, is an industry show where we actually talk about all of the news, because that is, and I get guests on who are knowledgeable about different games, because I think that's a massive void in the industry that hasn't been filled since Live on 3 died, like in 2013 or 2014, that there isn't an industry voice that really gives intelligent commentary that is trustworthy.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of fans want that, because even if I am not an Overwatch League or a COD fan, a lot of fans are asking questions. Well, what does the YouTube deal mean? And instead of just wild bullshit speculating, we could actually have people who understand the industry come on and give more informed opinions about it for people to make up their own minds thereafter. So I think that's a really big need.
Yeah. I think it'd be really good.
So that's definitely something that I'm working on. And then there's other shows, like we're building out a studio right now for Cloud9 here in Los Angeles that I'll be, you know, working on some other content out of. But just trying to build out some more, I would say, long form content is a goal with Cloud9 right now, not just in League of Legends, but in other games, industry general stuff as well. So yeah, there's a bunch of different avenues that we're currently exploring. And then obviously getting Flashpoint off the ground is a huge endeavor.
Yeah.
So working on that, and that's it right now.
Okay. So one of the things I wanted to ask you is, being a personality, someone who's out in the scene, it's not the easiest thing. And I know a lot of people kind of get, like, I've seen the hate that like you get, that like Thorin get, that like Richard Lewis get, like just people who kind of attack you. How do you kind of go day by day with all of these people who are kind of just angry at you guys all the time?
I hate, you know, it sucks to say this, and I wish I didn't have to say it, but you sort of get used to it after a while. I don't think anybody should have to get used to it. I think it's deeply inappropriate to personally insult people or to call them bigoted in some way on the internet. I think that calling somebody a bigot, in my opinion, is such a, it's a very deeply serious charge, and you really can't really throw around. That's like basically the worst thing you can say about somebody in the modern era. And I think that people who casually throw terms like that, like being racist or bigoted or sexist around, is really serious. And I think that it's unfortunate that people are so willing just to go out and say vile things about people or try and spread misinformation like that. And I think it's hurtful, and it's hard to deal with that, because I don't really know anybody, nor would I associate with them if I thought they were hateful for stupid reasons like that. And I certainly don't aspire to be that way myself. So it makes me sad. And I think that people should really evaluate before they start saying stuff like that. Casually.
Does it make it hard to kind of like put yourself out there, like to the world, to open yourself up to like the world? Because I feel like I would just want to, like, I would do the jobs that I had to, and I would do the best that I could, but I wouldn't want like anything about like me being shown to these people who are just so easily to like stab me.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me concerned. Sometimes I've been concerned about my own personal safety when it comes to death threats or other things that I've received. It does hurt my feelings. Like, I'm out there trying to do what I think is in the best interest of the industry. And I have a very strong personal philosophy and ethical code. And I try and live by that every day. And so to be shit on by people is tough. You know, it's not fun. And I, you know, like I said, you just learn not to care. But it does make me more reluctant to say things about my personal life because I, you know, I can take it and it's okay. But as soon as you start to involve things like my wife or my family, then, you know, you're starting to rope people into it that do not belong there. And it's, I need to make sure that that doesn't happen. And I think that people should be more considerate about the horrific things that are said. And this is, you know, honestly, it's particularly true of the Overwatch community, which is honestly like the most, I would say aggressive fan base in terms of attacking people's character.
Yeah.
And questioning their morality that I have ever seen. And it's very weird because it hasn't really been like in League. I would get death threats because people were mad because I didn't predict their team or some bullshit. And it was concerning, but it wasn't like, it wasn't vicious. Like as weird as it sounds, a death threat I perceive as less vicious than some of the deeply offensive and personal attacks that Overwatch fans have leveled, not only at me, but at players, at other casters, at everybody. It's very weird. And that's why I think the perception of Overwatch fans among the broader esports fan base is that they're fucking crazy. Which is, you know, maybe not unfair.
Okay. You mentioned you live by an ethical code. Can you go through some of the things that you would describe in your ethical code? I know for me, it's like this living by like truth. Like that's like a value that I hold. Is like I always want to be as honestly truthful with myself and others as I can be, which I still try to be respectful. But some people don't like that when you're just willing to actually tell them.
Yeah. Similarly, I mean, I really hate lying. I don't see a purpose to lying because it doesn't do anything for me. If I want something, I will just explicitly state it because I've just learned that at the end, first off, lying takes up way too much of my brain power because I have to remember all the lies and it's just stupid and a waste of time. But if I just put myself out there and just be as blunt and honest as I can be, then the reward is people know where you stand and then will use you for the things that you want to be used for. Right. Yeah. So I've almost had no repercussions from being just blunt and honest, because at the end of the day, I just get moved into positions that I want to be in because people know that that's what motivates me and they want to use me in an effective way. So, that's worked out quite well for me, I would say. I also just, you know, one of my goals, and I know this is somewhat ironic given what happened with Renegades, was I came into Renegades really wanting to provide players better contracts, which I did, and was one of the teams to first offer like sports psychology and that kind of like mental counseling, which I thought was very important. And there were things that I really wanted to change about the way that teams operate with players. Now, obviously, that didn't happen in exactly the way that I would have liked it to. And I regret some of the decisions that I made as part of that process. But it is important to me that people don't get scammed in this industry and that people have adequate support and that people are paid properly. And I've taken great personal risks and financial risks to myself in order to make that happen. And basically, the way I live my life is, would I rather die knowing that I did everything that I could to help this industry or make a few more dollars off of it? And the answer is the money is irrelevant. I would rather do everything in my power to make esports as good of a place as I can for everybody involved.
Okay. So I actually only have one last question for you. It is arguably the hardest question. It's what I ask all the time. So first, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure having you on here. I really enjoyed talking with you. I hope you enjoyed being on the show. If you didn't, it's too late.
Yeah.
You're already through it, so you're fucking stuck now. My last question for you, having been on the show, if you could see anyone to be on the show, Who would you like to see? And if you pick someone who I've had, I will let you know. The only criteria is they have to speak English because I only speak English. And they have to be involved in the entertainment industry somehow. So it doesn't necessarily have to be esports. It can be something else too. As long as it's the entertainment industry, it doesn't have to be a caster. It could be behind the scenes, in front of the scenes. It could be someone who does business development. As long as they're involved in entertainment.
I mean, I think what would be interesting is if you took somebody like Reaperd, the coach of Cloud9, because he now speaks English and he has been, I think he's just a deeply fascinating person because I've seen his whole career, but I would be very interested in hearing more about his personal life and his upbringing. And especially because he's been involved in League of Legends for so long, and that now that he actually, you know, in 2012, when I met him, he didn't speak any English, and now he's very good at English. So I think his entire journey has been one of not only seeing this industry rise and being a player and then being a coach and traveling all over the world, but also literally integrating into a new culture. I think it'd be fascinating.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show. If you have any shout outs, you're more than welcome to give them now. If you don't want any shout outs, I'll close out the show. It's completely up to you.
Thanks to Cloud9 and Flashpoint.
Okay.
Watch my shit.
Watch his shit. You heard it here. For everyone out there, this has been the Minds of Media. My name is Blake Panashevitz. And until next time, I hope you all have a wonderful day.